Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, has black enthusiasm for Barack Obama waned 3 years later? And preventive detention, who is the U.S. government preparing to lock up without charges or trial?
But first, the U.S. and its allies were on a military offensive in 2011, except in Iraq, where the Americans were forced to withdraw almost all of their uniform forces. But that doesn't mean the Americans are gone. We spoke with Tony Montera, professor of African American studies at Temple University in Philadelphia.
Don't forget, the bulk of the troops might be out of Iraq, but they're not out of the region. When you look at the Obama administration's policy, it is a continuation of the neoconservative policies of the Bush administration. And those policies were defined by the objective of regime change and bringing democracy, so-called, to the Middle East. And Iraq was supposed to be the first domino and the most important domino to fall in this respect. Now, the other side of that is, while they're allegedly moving out of Iraq, of course the troops are in Kuwait and other parts of the Persian Gulf, but the U.S. is ramping up its war talk against Iran. Iran is a neighbor of Iraq. In fact, Iran sits between Iraq and Afghanistan. So it is my opinion that this thing is not over, that the U.S., and this is, of course, Vice President Biden's point of view, United States should preserve the option of going back into Iraq. And certainly with the Maliki government under increasing stress and opposition, that government is not beyond, in the not-too-distant future, calling for the American troops to come back. And I guess the third thing I would say is that a lot of this has to do with the 2012 election. After the election, all bets are off. We have a new set of options. And we cannot forget that the largest U.S. embassy in the world is in Baghdad, Iraq. Over 17,000 so-called diplomats, but mainly CIA, military, intelligence. So Iraq is not over by a long shot.
The U.S. had a long list of nations marked for regime change. There has been regime change in Libya, and it appears that the United States and the Europeans are intent on making regime change in Syria.
And you know, even if they do not bring about complete regime change, they want to make these states, such as Libya, such as Syria, such as Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Iraq, failed states. States that in order to even exist or to function must rely upon the United States and NATO. So you have this attempt on the part of the United States and NATO to manage political, social, and economic chaos in the Middle East.
You were speaking of failed state. In the American mind, failed state goes easily with Somalia, and the United States has stepped up its proxies wars in Somalia and its direct military involvement.
And you talk about Somalia, and you talk about the Kenyan intervention there, but also we have to look at the Democratic Republic of Congo. And here you have three, maybe four, client states of the United States: Uganda, Kenya, and Rwanda, and maybe Burundi. And in certain respects and in certain instances, Ethiopia. So when you look at the destabilization process, and of course, AFRICOM, the Africa Command, you have to see it now crystallizing in the use of these military gendarmes like Kenya, like Uganda, like Rwanda. Of course, Somalia is important because of its strategic location on the Indian Ocean. And, of course, the Congo is hugely important because of its vast mineral and natural resources.
So in terms of Africa and the military threat to Africa, we have a NATO expeditionary force that has tested its weaponry in Libya. We have AFRICOM, which initially was the spearhead of the U.S. involvement in the Libyan operation and now has sent special forces into Central Africa. And we have these, as you call them, these client states, these gendarmes, these states that act as mercenaries for the United States in Africa.
And, you know, the thing that is so startling about this moment, at the height or the depth of the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression, and there are people who are saying that Europe is already in another Great Depression, you have this full court press, a strategic military full court press by the United States against all states that would seek independence, economic and political and military independence from the neo-colonial paradigm and framework constructed after African independence by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the major Western powers. I mean, Libya and Syria represent, in the Middle East, bulwarks against the neo-colonization of the Arab and Muslim world. In Africa, at one time, Somalia was part of a resistance to neo-colonialism. But I would say this whole thrust is an effort at the neo-colonization of the world. And, of course, they hope that they either have the cooperation or the acquiescence of the other big powers like China and Russia and the BRIC nations like South Africa and Brazil and India in this thrust. Because in order to carry it out, they need to have the cover of the United Nations and their interpretation of international law, especially humanitarian law. And if I could just add one other thing, Glenn, you know, this whole idea of upping the stakes in the so-called global war against terrorism, when now the United States homeland, as they call it, is part of the global war against terrorism. And now this attempt to redefine a new axis of evil, a new trio of evil that includes Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba, and this whole propaganda that Cuba and Venezuela, along with Iran, are funding with Mexican drug money terrorists who seek to harm the American people. Now, all of us who are in one or another way in solidarity and have been in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution, with 21st century socialism in Venezuela, are now at the top of a hit list of terrorist supporters who could be arrested and detained indefinitely. So, you know, we're in a really important, it seems to me, moment, a moment where the forces of national liberation and national independence and the forces of working class and people's struggles are merging into this great global movement that has to oppose this thrust of international thrust of finance capital and the Obama administration and the other NATO countries. And this has to be done from our point of view, on our side, in the interest of preventing the consolidation, not just the rise, but the rise and consolidation of new forms of fascism that in the 21st century could and most likely would take on a global united front going way beyond anything Hitler imagined.
What does it mean domestically when Americans, for example, oppose the new regime that the United States and Europe are trying to impose on the world? What can be interpreted by the United States government in terms of preventive detention as lending substantial support to what they call terrorist groups?
First of all, I think that the claim of support to terrorists is just a fraud and a fig leaf, behind which is their effort to find a way to crush the rising economic resistance of what we now call the 99%, or the majority of people who have been awakened by this Occupy movement. So I think that on the one side, they have to crush the rising, what we might call, class conflict in the United States and in other Western capitalist countries. But on the other side, and this is the neocolonial side of this, they have to neocolonize and destabilize those parts of the world which have these strategic minerals, be it the Democratic Republic of Congo, be it Libya, be it Iraq, be it Venezuela. And by the way, Venezuela has, by some estimate, the largest amount of oil reserves of any nation in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So you have this two-sided project: crush domestic opposition to economic austerity, and at the same time, crush the movement for economic independence around the world. The other side of this is that they see both of these movements as part and parcel of a larger future anti-imperialist unity movement. Because the people in Occupy, the people in the Free Mumia movement, the people in many of these political grassroots movements, the people in Wisconsin, you know, who got those signatures to recall that governor out there, in the end, these movements will merge at a certain new level of consciousness. And that consciousness will be both against economic, domestic austerity and against imperialist wars. You know, like saying austerity for the people, but war spending does not come under the same rubric of cuts and so on. Bail out the banks as they're doing in Europe, but the people have to pay for it. At some point, something has to give. And they know that. And what they are proposing is a regime of domestic and global repression. I like to refer to it as a global regime of fascism.
And that fascism will take different forms in the 21st century than the so-called classic fascism of Germany and Italy.
And you know, we already see it. You know, on the one side, it will use the cover of national security, but then in countries like Hungary, right-wing and pro-fascist forces will come to power through elections using the economic crisis, but then they will flip the script, that is, rewrite the Constitution, which in some ways will make elections less democratic and less popular. So you're right. It will come in many, many different ways. One of the things that this new regime of global fascism will do is to use international law and international organizations like the UN, and in particular the UN Security Council, to rationalize and justify their behavior throughout the world.
Black folks could never imagine, many still cannot imagine, the man coming knocking at the door to take them away under a President Obama. Yet President Obama quite clearly finessed the preventive detention bill through Congress.
This is one of the great ideological and really psychological challenges that Afro-America has perhaps ever faced. It is a sophisticated assault from many sides upon us to prevent the African American people from playing the role that they have played or we have played in previous moments of crisis in American history. Everything from the resistance to slavery and the transatlantic slave trade, to our role in the Civil War, our fight in the unions in the 1930s, I mean, up to the Civil Rights Movement, we find a troubling quietness among black folk at this time of crisis. And of course, you know, a lot of weight falls upon the shoulders of people like yourself and myself and progressive activists and intellectuals to keep ideological heat upon the apologists for this repressive regime, which at this time is headed by a man who looks like most of us.
That was Professor Tony Montara at Temple University in Philadelphia.
It's a presidential election year again, and if 2012 is anything like 2008, the traditional black organizations will avoid at all costs saying anything that might embarrass the first black president. The rise of Barack Obama saw the collapse of most independent black politics, but it also caused the formation of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, which held its first protest march at the White House in November of 2009. Black Is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela says Obama will still get the black vote, but there won't be much passion.
If you would ask the question, then the majority of people will say that they still support Obama, and that in part is because at this juncture, because of the general weakness of our movement, people don't necessarily understand an alternative to Obama, but it's different this time. It's not the same as before when people thought in Obama they had a real champion that was going to make a difference in the lives of black people materially and psychologically, emotionally, and all the other kinds of ways, but it didn't happen. And my experience is just as recently as 2 days ago, talking to a brother from Birmingham, Alabama, who actually were campaigned throughout the United States and throughout the South for Obama, even though he says he may do it again, he is not saying that with enthusiasm and actually feels like he was had by Obama the first time around. So I don't think that we're going to see the same kind of enthusiasm. In fact, I know we're not going to see the same kind of enthusiasm for Obama this time around. And because people literally thought things were going to happen for them. And even if they don't blame Obama for things not happening for them, they still have this experience of it not meaning anything meaningful for them that Obama was elected. We won't see the same kind of response to Obama this time around, not positive response anyway. And the conditions of existence for people, the question of joblessness, the question of homelessness, the questions of being able to see their children go to school, be protected from police violence and things like that. These things are impacting on people and make people more inclined to want to mobilize against these conditions, even if they don't do it in the name of opposing Obama. I think we're going to see a lot more opposition to conditions and therefore indirectly, at least to Obama and his policies.
You seem to be saying that black support of Obama in this election year will be motivated more by fear than enthusiasm.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. If we can even anticipate a greater fear. I mean, I know the last time around we heard many of our black leftist friends and pseudo-nationalists and things like that who were predicting that if Obama didn't get elected, we would have the police control, a police state, etc. But people have experienced that with Obama. People, we were told that what it was going to be like in terms of economic catastrophe, political disaster, etc. But that has occurred even with Obama there. So I don't know. I'd be really interested in seeing the fear element that they can introduce to this situation. I think that the only thing that they can do is move against Obama in a certain way. So that will allow black people in this country to interpret that as moving against him because he's black. And therefore, that will give them a stake vicariously to defend themselves through defending Obama. Other than that, I don't even know what more they can do in terms of frightening people.
Bush did not make a blanket claim to the right to kill anyone, including American citizens, anywhere in the world, anytime he felt like it. And Bush did not get past a preventive detention for American citizens bill.
No, not only did he not do that, but I'm trying to remember a time when Bush was actually on the scene or actually directly involved in ordering assassinations, as Obama did with the so-called Somali pirates, the young people who, one of whom was executed by a sniper on the spot from direct orders from Obama. Obama presiding over the most extraordinary situation from the White House, actually watching the assassination of this old man, Osama bin Laden, in Pakistan. I mean, this kind of hands-on involvement in actual carrying out of assassinations is extraordinary. It's akin to mafia types actually taking somebody out to involve them directly in the hit so that they don't have the ability to tell on anybody else because of their own culpability. It's extraordinary. So, no, Obama has outdone Bush in a lot of ways, and the escalation of the military aggression against people, the escalation, the use of drone assassinations, more than anything that Bush ever did. And as you've mentioned, the declaration of the right to kill even U.S. citizens when he wants to. It's been a hell of a ride with this guy around. There's a great possibility that he'll be reelected, but he won't be reelected with the same kind of fanfare from the black community. And I think he's going to be extraordinarily vulnerable to opposition actions, mass actions by the black community. I think people will be a lot less reluctant to strike out against the Obama regime this time around than they were before.
So do you think the long quiet in terms of black grassroots political activity may be over soon?
It may be over soon, but the thing that we are watching with the Wall Street kind of occupation activity and many Africans kind of sort of being related to it, many kind of critical because they don't feel like it's addressing our questions, but a sense of anticipation and need to struggle anyway is something that's being realized. And one of the other things anyway is that we see being discarded a lot of the old leadership, the old compromising, in bed with the Democratic Party kind of leadership, a lot of that's being pushed aside. It's not even meaningful anymore. The absolute unity with the Sharptons and the Obama regime, they've just become really insignificant. So I think that is one of the things that's going to give rise and opportunity for more forces to be expressing themselves this time around. And certainly we're extraordinarily busy, and what we're seeing is a lot of young people in particular who are being attracted to activism and to questions of self-determination and anti-imperialism in the African community. And a lot more sophisticated than what we would have seen 15, 20 years ago in terms of being able to be opposed to imperialism itself and not just white this and black that, even though they obviously motivated by what is happening to us as black people, the analysis is growing. And I think Obama is going to contribute to that as well.
What do you see Black is Back doing in the next year?
One of the things that I really anticipate Black is Back doing, in addition to increasing activism, we're going to see more growth. And one of the things that's exciting to me is the great likelihood of being able to be involved in international action, such as what London did this time around. And Black is Back activists attempted to do a mobilization at the NATO headquarters along with the action that we did in Philly on November 5th, but it was just a little too complicated. That's in Belgium. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that. It makes me proud to see the YouTube and other kinds of videos of Africans, black people in London and in Belgium. In fact, I was in Belgium just a few weeks ago, and you know, one of the speakers, you know, wore a Black is Back t-shirt, and I think that's one of the things that people are seeing as a unifying thing. I know that's happening in England. People are seeing the Black is Back coalition as an incredibly significant vehicle for uniting different and diverse black organizations on a common anti-imperialist trajectory.
The worse the economic situation gets for capital, the more aggressive they seem to get at home and abroad. But that's not unusual, is it?
It's not unusual. But I think that it's not the same for them this time around. I think that their aggression now is one more of desperation, unlike the past where the imperialists could use gunboat diplomacy and people could deplore it because they saw this all-powerful entity just trampling on the rights and sovereignties and resources of the peoples around the world at will. Today, that's not the case. They can't do it at will. And people are responding to them around the world, and that's deepening the crisis economically, psychologically, and various other ways. And so in the past, it was so easy for them to employ military means to transfer the crisis of imperialism onto the backs of oppressed peoples in Africa and Asia and South America. Today, that's extraordinarily complicated. We see movements throughout South America. We see movements in various parts of the Middle East, and especially in Asia, as China is gobbling up much of the political and economic space that the U.S. used to be able to control with its other imperialist allies. In Africa, we see what's happening in North Africa, and there are expressions of resistance happening in Africa south of the Sahara, too. So, yeah, they are moving militarily much more aggressively than we've seen in the past, but this aggression is one of desperation as opposed to what we saw in the past. And whatever they do, the problem is that they're not going to be able to put the genie back in the bottle. The economy is not going to get any better. The relations of power in the whole world are not going to improve to their benefit. China is this growing force, not only in Asia, but throughout the world. It is fast removing U.S. as the most significant economic and political force in Africa. It is fastest growing economy in the world. There's indication that shortly China would have the largest economy in the world, surpassing the United States. That's happening, and that will have a powerful psychological impact. And if you read even some of the political pundits of the United States, they are also really aware and concerned about the change in demographics inside the United States. By 2040-something, the U.S. will no longer be a majority white country. Now, these are all things that factor into the psychological, political, and economic situation in this country and around the world.
Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition.
The U.S. anti-war movement, what little that was left of it, mostly put itself out of business in 2008, disappearing into the Obama election effort. In the intervening 3 years, the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, has emerged as the premier U.S. peace organization. UNAC spokesperson Chris Gavreau says newly enacted preventive detention legislation threatens all political dissent in the U.S.
Well, this is really the most serious blow to the Bill of Rights that we've experienced, and it's no accident that it's occurring while Obama, the White House, the Pentagon, and NATO are basically expanding military adventures abroad. I think that the immediate threat, of course, is to the Muslim American community, who has already, for the sake of war propaganda against regimes in the Middle East and resistors in the Middle East, have been the victims already for many years of preemptive prosecution, entrapment by combined force of FBI and police agents, confinement in solitary confinement units called CMUs, communication management units, and so forth. And now that community, the politically active members of that community, those who are aware and feel responsible for civil rights, for the civil rights of their members and colleagues, really fear a very serious increase in the number of unjust jailings of folks from the Muslim community.
Clearly, the United States and its allies are on a military offensive abroad. I guess that's being reflected domestically with measures like preventive detention.
Absolutely. It's very clear that this is going to be used as a weapon of terror, basically, against the Muslim American community. Each time that they entrap a Muslim American or basically put fear into the leadership of a mosque, which they do by threatening an imam that if he does not, quote, report to them on the doings in his mosque, that he'll be deported and so forth. Each time they carry out these things, they weaken the ability of the population to mobilize against the wars. And they try to create fear, try to create the illusion that there's a serious, quote, terrorist threat in the United States. It's very clear by looking at all the cases so far that the vast majority of them involve victimized members of the community who have no intention of carrying out any political act, but were basically set up and goaded into some sort of activity that could plausibly be explained in the court as a threat. And it's part of a massive propaganda campaign to increase support for the huge new military budget. I guess it was $680 billion that was codified in the same law that legalized indefinite detention.
The key word seems to be substantial support. Can the federal government charge you with giving substantial support to people that they call terrorists? Well, what the hell is substantial support?
Well, we have a lot of experience in the last 10 years with just what the government means by some of these terms. Recently, there was a conviction after many appeals of the leadership of a charitable organization called the Holy Land Trust. They were convicted of giving, quote, material support to Palestinians that the U.S. considered terrorists. Now, what was their actual act? Their actual act was contributing to child care centers and health organizations in Gaza and the West Bank. And, of course, it was a totally legitimate and humanitarian activity that the U.S. now charges somehow aids terrorism. I don't know if you're aware, but these laws, these material support laws, have now been extended to encompass speech. There was a very famous court decision where an NGO, a nonprofit organization, wanted to counsel a nationalist group in the Middle East with ways to achieve their aims without violence, that is, through elections and negotiations. And that individual, that organization, was too charged under the penalty of material support terrorism. Basically, the U.S. government's creating a situation where any kind of speech or expression of ideas of support for liberation struggles abroad, for human rights abroad, dislike of a, quote, U.S. ally in a region, there are court precedents for the U.S. government treating that as material or substantial support to, quote, terrorist organizations. The language is so broad, the application has been so disingenuous that we now have enough precedent to understand that they will use these laws against anyone that they seriously think is a threat to their ability to implement foreign policy. And that can be someone doing educational work, expressing political opposition to the U.S. wars abroad. You know, the anti-war and solidarity activists in the Midwest, in Chicago, who've been threatened with being brought for a grand jury, basically were targeted because they were doing solidarity work with people and raising money for child care centers in Palestine and for human rights, the victims of human rights violations in Colombia. But because their activities highlighted what they considered the immorality of U.S. foreign policy in those regions, the U.S. was able to use all the language and legal decisions that are now codified in the new law, in the NDAA, to threaten to bring them before a grand jury. Really, we're facing a full-blown, the possibility of a full-blown witch hunt. And it's incredibly important that the entire movement rally together to begin to call for the repeal of the NDAA, to carry out enough political activity, educational activity, dissemination of information, that it becomes politically much more difficult for the government to implement this stuff. One way that people can do that is by protesting at the NATO G8 summit in May in Chicago. All these measures are designed to bolster the military and economic activity of NATO and the G8. And we're going to be planning a broad campaign to fight around indefinite detention and other civil liberties violations at a national conference that the United National Anti-War Committee will be holding March 23rd to 25th in Stanford, Connecticut. And I urge anyone who wants to begin to fight this really terrifying legislation, this terrifying announcement of what the U.S. government is willing to do, not only abroad but on U.S. soil, to join us at that conference. And you can find out about it by going to www.unacpeace.org. That's unacpeace.org.
That was Chris Gavreau of the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo blew the whistle on racism and corporate favor at the Federal Environmental Protection Agency more than a decade ago, which led to legislation to protect whistleblowers from retaliation. Ms. Coleman Adebayo continues the fight against environmental racism as part of Occupy Washington, D.C. She's also an editor and columnist with Black Agenda Report. In a recent article titled Shooting the Messenger, Coleman Adebayo warned that whistleblowers can't expose injustices if the media refuses to hear the whistle.
Well, I think what's interesting where we're at right now historically is that while there is still a myth of freedom of speech, what's happening is that worldwide, globally, journalists are being drowned out. So there was a new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists that said that 2011 was a very, very sad period in our global history in terms of the way journalists are being treated. For example, as of December 1st of this year, there were 179 writers, editors, reporters, and photographers behind bars. And that's a 34% jump from last year. Now, in countries where we're seeing a lot of conflict in the Middle East and in North Africa, there was a 50% increase this year. And in Iran and other countries like that, you have almost 45, 50 journalists behind bars. I think the point is that the journalists that dare to speak truth to power, that dare to speak the truth, that dare to inform the community, are under siege right now globally. And that should really make all of us take a deep breath and be very concerned about what's happening to people who are dedicated to providing information to all of us.
Where is the whistleblower if there is nobody to blow the whistle to?
That's the point, isn't it? I mean, journalists as whistleblowers, whistleblowers as whistleblowers. You know, at some point it would be lovely to see those two communities merged, because in the 1930s, 1940s, particularly in Detroit with the trade union movement and journalists who were so committed to mudrucking and or so committed to getting information out to the community, you actually saw journalists taking up the mantle as whistleblowers as journalism became more corporate and there was more pressure and more influence by the government on journalists. Saw journalists retreating and taking much safer positions. It's interesting, when you look at the history of journalism under apartheid, for example, you see journalists taking incredible risks, not only professional risks, but also risks to their lives, coming out and trying to get the information to the public, to the global community, about what life was like under apartheid. And now, since we're in this era of quote-unquote liberation in South Africa, you see more journalists pulling back in South Africa because of the risk involved in telling the truth about what's happening under a black government in South Africa. So the challenges right now confronting journalists throughout the world. But I think no place greater, quite frankly, than the United States. And that's where I think Noam Chomsky's work is so instructive. Because for a long time he's been talking about the United States government, though the news media is a vehicle of propaganda,
And his hypothesis has been that in very restrictive societies, people are actually freer to think whatever it is they think, or to follow truth wherever it may lead. But in a society like the United States, where people don't suspect that our newspapers are vehicles of propaganda, people believe that what they're reading is actually the truth. And so it's been a very interesting dance between whistleblowing and journalists, and also trying to help the American public not really see the New York Times as all the news that there is to print, to understand that we have a state-run media in this country, what we call the corporate media now, that is influenced more by corporate pressure and by money and by politics than the search for the truth.
So, in fact, we see most corporate journalists not as whistleblowers, but as extensions of the prevailing order.
As the state, exactly. And so what I argue in my piece is that we're looking at state journalism, and that that's the way we should view most of the media that comes out of corporate media. It's just the way we were taught to view the work that came out of the former Soviet Union, or out of when the Soviets dominated Eastern Europe. That's exactly the kind of press we have in some ways. It's obviously much more sophisticated, and it's much more ingrained in Americans not to question institutions like the New York Times or Washington Post, and to believe that that reporting is quote-unquote objective reporting. But in fact, what I tried to argue is that organizations like Barr, or organizations that are not connected to the banking system, to the propaganda coming out of the White House, that really is the place where we're seeing this blurred line between whistleblowing and journalism, which I think is really frontline reporting at this point.
We have a strange situation today in which some people recognize that there are sectors of the media that are directly lying to them on behalf of the all-powerful, but usually they believe that's limited to Fox News and that CNN and the rest are somehow more objective.
Right. Well, I take that up in my piece a little bit because, you know, I look at some of the quote-unquote more liberal shows on MSNBC, which is considered a very, very, very liberal station. And I looked at one instance, in fact, where the EPA administrator was doing a series of little junkets around MSNBC. And this was right after a major article had come out in the New York Times that deconstructed what happened with the last clean air provisions that Lisa Jackson, the head of the EPA, had proposed to the White House. This was a very serious proposal that she had made to the White House. In fact, we know that she told the White House, she told the president, that unless he signed this regulation to reduce smog, that 7,200 people would die per year, that we'd have about 11,000 visits to the emergency room because of asthma and bronchitis and other life-threatening diseases, and that we'd have about 38,000 new cases of asthma triggered. And we found out in this New York Times article that instead of science dictating whether or not the president would sign on to the new smog regulations, he tossed it over to Bill Daley, who he placed in the White House to take care of corporate concerns. That's his job in the White House, or was his job in the White House, was to appease corporate concerns. And Bill Daley, in fact, made the decision that the president should not sign off on the smog regulations. So they simply called Lisa Jackson over to the White House and gave her marching orders, told her that he wasn't going to sign the new regulations, and that I assume that she should go out and still push whatever other programs that he wanted tossed to the American public. Well, what happens to that? She goes on a number of shows on MSNBC, and no one asked her about that particular regulation. Unbelievable. They threw her these little sweetheart kisses of questions, but no one really challenged her on why she decided to acquiesce to President Obama's order stand down on smog regulations.
So effectively, MSNBC, the media outlet that's seen as liberal and more journalistic than the rest, is actually protecting power, that is, protecting the president.
Yeah, that's the point that I'm making, that it seems that at certain levels, particularly when you have a lot of influence and there's a lot of media attention and there's an incredible amount of exposure, that people are all protecting their jobs, they're protecting their backside, and that even the liberal media in this country tends to protect their corporate sponsors. And maybe that's just obvious. But so in that case, where do we find real freedom of speech? Where do we find reporting that really exposes the underbelly of the political system that we're living with right now? And what I'm suggesting is that we find it in media like BAR. We find it in media like Truth Out. We find it in other forms where people are writing in who are not technically considered journalists, perhaps, but are people who are doing the research and trying to get the information out to the public.
In a sense, then, such media should not be called alternative journalism, but actually the journalism. And what passes for journalism from corporate sources isn't journalism at all.
Exactly. So that's what I would argue. I would argue that we have to begin to rethink the words that we use and the way we think about these categories. You know, I think it's, you know, one of the things that, again, Noam Chomsky always does, he talks about corporate media. And I know that you talk about corporate media. And I think that's really helpful when people are thinking through these very complex issues, is to use words that really express the issue that we're dealing with. And when we're dealing with NBC or ABC or whatever, New York, I think we need to always consciously talk about capitalist media, corporate media, imperialist media, because that helps us put what they're writing about in context.
And what we shouldn't do is refer to it as mainstream media, as some people who consider themselves part of the left do, because that's not a media that speaks from the mainstream or to the mainstream or the 99%'s interest, but for the corporations.
Exactly. And I think, you know, when we're talking about foreign policy, I mean, I'd like to see our language reflect the reality of the American political system. And it's interesting to me, you know, how we're trying to skirt around what happened in Iraq. No one wants to call it imperialism. And I think that on one level, we need to start talking about imperial ventures. We need to start so that people begin to get used to our usage of the language in a way that's really educational and descriptive and helps people understand the linkages between the news that they're reading, if it's out of the New York Times, and the political position that's coming out of the White House, whether it's a Democratic or Republican Party pursuing whatever imperial adventures of the day. But I think it would help us to be more descriptive and more clear about what we're writing about and what people are actually reading.
Yes, it is hard to think when your very language does not conform to reality.
Exactly. And I think that that's one of the problems that we're having also with the Occupy movement. The language needs to be much clearer in terms of what does it mean to be a part of the 99 versus the 1%. The class warfare that we're talking about, how, because America has injected this issue of middle class into this language as opposed to working class. And so at some point, you know, we need to have language that helps everyone understand that if you're working, and you must work, because if you don't work, you will starve, then you're working class, as opposed to this very amorphous language of being middle class, and then somehow you think that you're better than, I suppose, lower class people. So that we need to get a real grip on the language that we use.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo, speaking from Maryland.
It's been more than a year since cholera broke out in Haiti, brought there by troops of the United Nations Occupation Force, MINUSCA. 6,000 have died, but the UN hasn't even offered an apology to the Haitian people. Fran Quigley, director of the Health and Human Rights Clinic at the University of Indiana Law School, recently returned from a trip to Haiti. He says the UN talks constantly about the rule of law, but it doesn't practice what it preaches.
It's really a great opportunity for the UN in a place like Haiti where folks with power, whether they're powerful military officials or powerful political officials or powerful because they just simply have the money and resources have traditionally been able to do what they want. You know, they've been able to operate above the law in imprisoning or killing their political enemies and stealing money from the public treasury and just basically operating with total impunity. And the UN rightly has condemned Haiti and other countries that have a practice like that and have called on folks in leadership and power to hold themselves in a position where they're accountable for the law. So here's the UN, though, with, you know, really a mountain of evidence that they are responsible for this horrible outbreak that has killed thousands of people and sickened a half million people in Haiti, in a country and people who have already suffered so much. And it really seems like a great opportunity for the UN to say, okay, you know, we're powerful, we're an international, you know, the international player and in many of these respects. But we made a mistake. We need to take responsibility for it and pay the price and try to make things better.
And, of course, there is no question about the UN's culpability. Lots of disasters have befallen Haiti, man-made and natural, over the years. But in half a century, it hasn't had cholera.
No. And, you know, in the United Nations' own report is really the most persuasive evidence of the United Nations' culpability here. It shows that the strain – oh, actually summarizes some other reports as well. It shows that the strain of cholera that's affected and sickened and killed so many people in Haiti is identical to the one in Nepal. It shows that the outbreak of cholera coincides both geographically and in terms of timeline with the introduction of a new set of peacekeeping troops from Nepal to a particular base in Haiti, and that the outbreak goes right along the river that comes from that base, and also that investigations of that base show some, you know, really shoddy forms of waste disposal. And so, you know, it all adds up to a very, very convincing case that the United Nations has this responsibility. And most of that evidence comes from the United Nations itself. However, unfortunately, to date, they have not accepted responsibility for it. And of course, the delay hurts the people of Haiti.
Haiti has been reduced to a kind of protectorate of the United Nations. Why doesn't the UN protect it? It seems like it's more intent on protecting its own prerogatives and those of the United States and France and Canada.
It really is very disappointing that the United Nations has not yet stepped up and taken responsibility and more importantly, done what it can do to alleviate the suffering and then to prevent this from happening again. And of course, the people of Haiti are very aware of this and had a significant demonstration. I was in Haiti a few weeks ago and the day after I left in front of one of the UN peacekeeping bases. And, you know, very eloquently said that, you know, this is, you talk about universal human rights. Well, you know, Haiti is part of the universe too. And we should have our rights protected from everybody. And unfortunately, in this case, it includes the United Nations. And if the UN is truly committed to the safety and health and well-being of the Haitian people, they're going to need to step up and take responsibility and do what they can to give recompense and to the people who have been affected and try to prevent this from happening again.
And not just restore them to physical health, but to political health, which in the modern world, in civilized world, means independence.
Right, and of course, it's even before, long before this cholera outbreak that's been attributed to the UN peacekeepers. It's been a very controversial presence in Haiti, and folks who were there will tell you. You know, you look and you go down the streets of Port-au-Prince, for instance, and you see folks getting along with each other in a peaceable manner, and then you see this armored vehicle rolling down the street with soldiers from another country armed to the teeth. It just really doesn't seem to fit, and of course, there's no civil war going on in Haiti, nor has there been, and an awful lot of people think that, you know, it's been long since time for the peacekeepers to leave, even before this very, very deadly cholera outbreak.
What was your sense of the Haitian people's attitude towards MINUSTAH, the United Nations Armed Occupation Mission?
I think that, you know, from the Haitian folks that I spoke to, is, you know, that there's clearly there's a lot more harm than good coming from that their presence at this time. And again, the cholera outbreak is plenty of evidence enough, but it's not the only one. There's been an awful lot of misdeeds and criminal activity and tortious activity by UN peacekeepers and who've had the presence in Haiti for so long. And it's something that when you put the peacekeepers in a country, and I'm not saying that there's no time or place for that to happen, but when they're there and they're there for such a long time and they have this, you know, immunity from prosecution, it's inevitable it's going to cause these kind of problems. And unfortunately, in this case, you know, just a massive breakdown in being sensitive to your hosts when you actually are, you know, negligently dumping untreated waste into a major waterway, and it's sickening 500,000 people. You'd think the first thing the United Nations would be doing would be issuing a very significant and sincere apology, and then the next thing they'd be doing is what can we do to make it better? But neither of those things have happened.
You speak of keeping the peace. That's what they're supposed to be keeping, but a peace from who?
If the United Nations would focus on, you know, empowering and training and supporting the Haitian police force capacity, then that, boy, that'd be, I think, a much better solution. And I think most Haitians would say that's a much better solution than bringing in soldiers from Nepal or the United States or any place else to patrol the streets.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.